Is this it then? Because I remember you saying...
I don't know, man. It's never up to me. It's up to Malkmus. I think he's enjoyed doing Pavement. I think he's well aware of it's the thing that he's most recognized for.
Is he at peace with that, or is he battle against it like a Wings Beatles thing? You know the answer to that. Come on. Welcome to Discograffiti, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. In this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on Bob Nastanovich as we dive headfirst into the collective soul of a generation. Welcome, then, to Stray Slack Double Fantasy as Gen X slides into middle age and he and I both come tumbling after. In this episode, Bob talks with Discograffiti about the changes that have occurred to the show as a direct result of his appearances rating the entirety of the Pavement catalog beginning at episode 49, the short film about me fitting him with hearing aids called Perfect Sound Forever, and a true surprise at the end when you hear what's about to roll down the pike. Coming up, we've got Dennis Ryan from Deertick rating Bombino, Corey Hansen from Wand rating everything he's ever done, an interview with Testament's lead guitar shredder Alex Skolnick, Mike Watt rating the entirety of the Minutemen's output, Mark Robinson from Unrest rating everything he's ever done, Robert Schneider from the Apples in Stereo rating everything he's ever done, and Will Hart from the Olivia Drummer Control rating everything they ever did. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And for premium membership benefits that'll make you ask yourself, how's it even humanly conceivable that this is all the work of one man and one man alone, just visit patreon.com/discograffiti. We've got 100 episodes available exclusively on Patreon, and that number, as well as the Discograffiti inner circle, is growing exponentially by the day. That's patreon.com/discograffiti. And away we go then with Bob Nastanovich. So I've been turning it over, like what to do here. And I kept coming back to this one quote. And I don't know if you know the quote, but it's something that has stuck with me through the years. And I kept thinking about you and about Pavement, about following artistic dreams, where that leaves us, a 25-year-old on a stage versus a 50-year-old on a stage, whatever. So here's the quote, and it's John Lennon talking about the whole process of making Double Fantasy. John said, "What we sing about in the record and the songs are real diaries of how we feel. We're not presenting ourselves as the perfect couple. We have our problems, we have our doubts, but we're trying. We want to stay together." And then, not him, but whoever was writing about this, it was to be a work by adults who had survived their rebellious youth, finally figured out what was most important to them, and were now writing for their peers. Back to Lennon. When I was singing and working with Yoko, I was visualizing all the people of my age group from the 60s being in their 30s or 40s now, just like me, and having wives and children, and having gone through everything together. I'm singing to them. I'm saying, here I am now. How are you? How's your relationship going? Did you get through it all? Wasn't the 70s a drag? Let's try to make the 80s good, because it's still up to us to make what we can of it. It's not out of our control. I still believe in love, peace. So what I wanted the conversation really to revolve around then, in a kind of way, is not the band, because we did the band. You know, we talked about Pavement, about us, about, you know, the generation, sort of me implicating myself as much as, you know, talking about you. And I know it sounds maybe a little bit aspirational, but at the end of it all, there is a point to this. And I think over the last year, I've gotten swallowed alive by ambitions that were only initially coming to life back in the Slack era, so to speak. And here I am again. And it's still a heavily Pavement saturated time. And so you guys really are. Yeah, you guys are the kind of band that is a harbinger of life change. And lightning can strike twice when you guys are around. Yeah. So I was thinking, no Slack, masks off, no poses. And initially, the idea, and my wife talked me out of it, was since I rated you guys, I give you 50 of my life decisions and you rate
them. Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to do. 50's
yeah, yeah. 50 is too many. But then 15. I figured, you know what? Let's just keep it loose. Doesn't have okay. to be like a...
I kind of like your idea. I was looking forward to talking about something other than myself and pavement.
We did.
I'm a little beleaguered these days. Yeah, but I mean, I'm always willing to try to experiment with conversation, I guess, and see if it works. And then, of course, you know, if you don't like it, you can always scrap it.
Yeah, I don't think that would happen. I mean, the falling off the stage.
That was crazy. That was an incident. I feel like I told that story so many times, and perhaps I haven't told it in the last 60 days because everybody I know has already heard it. So, I mean, whenever you injure yourself that severely, and we'll talk about your recent injury or whatever happened to you that traumatized your body, there are certain days where you feel like the damage is going to be permanent or there's going to be ramifications or maybe, I mean, the big fear is infection. I mean, I've been very fortunate. You know, it's been a tough several months. You know, I suffered kind of an unfortunate injury, set of injuries.
You too, huh? What happened?
Without knowing it, I walked off the end of a 6-foot stage in Melbourne, Australia, in the fourth song of our set, and I severely injured both of my legs. And
Jesus.
Yeah, I didn't. I guess adrenaline and embarrassment sort of carried me through. I mean, I got up and I didn't lose consciousness, and I sort of like looked at all the faces of the concert goers in Melbourne. I saw a few hundred and they were all just like, I could immediately tell their faces sort of suggested that fear and like that they'd seen something horrible. And wasn't the first time that happened. Actually, it happened to me as a young boy, a similar situation. So at the time, you know, it's amazing how far adrenaline will take you, because that was like, I think we were playing Gold Sounds. It was like the fourth or fifth song of the set. And I got up and worked my way, I continued playing tambourine in the audience. And I worked my way back onto the stage and played another 20 songs. And in between the main set and the encore, I went up to our tour manager, Mike Fry, and I said, Mike, you know, as soon as this is over, I need to go into your office. And we need to look at both my legs, because my right leg had already swollen quite a bit. It was becoming difficult to lift. So then after the concert, I mean, this is just from basically the end of the stage. It was very, very dark and you couldn't see where it ended. And I was sure that I had, obviously I wasn't trying to injure myself. I was sure that I had a lot more room. And then I put my left foot out and there was just nothing there but an orchestra pit. And then on the way down, my right leg landed on this wooden railing thing. So I had massive contusions on my right leg and left leg, but I had a huge laceration on my left shin.
How far back was this?
Whenever we played in Australia, I think it was February. So when I went into his office, I saw my injuries for the first time. Then I guess I had three separate fainting episodes. And so they took me to the emergency room and I was in there for like about 30 hours. I missed a gig. It was only the second pavement show I ever missed. I missed a gig in Geelong, a festival in Geelong. I feel badly that I missed it. In fact, it looked like they were going to release me from the hospital about an hour before it started. And then I would have had an opportunity to do a far, far less dramatic and far less significant sort of curtain Cobain at Reading type maneuver.
I'm glad you're okay, man.
Yeah, no, then I went to New Zealand a couple days later and I played those shows. And, you know, it was just kind of baby stepping for a while. Really, the huge mistake I made was flying from Wellington, New Zealand to Auckland to Houston to Nashville and driving back here to Paris, Tennessee. And the condition I was in, that was too big of an ask. It became sort of apparent to me halfway, somewhere in between Auckland, New Zealand, and Houston, Texas, that I might die on a plane because my legs had sort of swollen like 1.5 times their normal size. So yeah, that was the really scary part. And then, you know, basically for about 30 days, I was pretty much very, very limited.
Yeah.
But yeah, everything's all right. Yeah, that's the most significant thing that's happened to me.
I guess the last time we spoke was 10 months ago, and there's been such an avalanche of stuff.
Yeah, you've been moved to New Jersey, I see.
Yeah, crazy shit. I almost bled to death.
Oh, what was that? Was that an accident?
Well, no, it was definitely not on purpose.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, yeah, otherwise you'd probably be in a mental hospital.
Exactly. Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and four-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discograffiti is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. My monthly income at the moment totals a whopping $760. Becoming a member of Discograffiti's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more episodes, and moving forward, you'll get up to 3 shows a week. There's the main show every Friday, Wednesday's brand new series, The Top 10, and Monday's wildcard episode, which could be anything from interview bonus material, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, and exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discograffiti. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti. And now back to our expertly crafted program.
You know, as long as you survive these things and, you know, sort of learn your lesson, for example, I'll always sort of examine where the end of the stage is. Or perhaps maybe I should stop acting like I'm 25 on stage and act like I'm 65 instead of my age. So,
okay, so that is what this show is. So to be honest with you, it's become like a mental exercise for me the past week or so. Like, what is... Because I don't take it lightly, first of all, asking anyone's time. But then also, I knew I didn't want to do the same old thing with you.
Why is it always me? Like, how come I always have to be the guy you don't do the same old thing with? I mean, like, last time I was on the show, like, I had to talk about my own band. Other people get to talk about other bands.
You haven't been keeping up then, because since then, you have been the harbinger of a great many revolutions in this corner of the world. I'm not kidding, man. So you and I recorded on August 14th, 2022. Here's the timeline. We recorded.
It was a very long year.
It was objectively the greatest conversation two people have ever had. And that was 4 hours, and we got up to Wowie Zowie. On August 21st, we recorded 4 more hours. On September 9th, I fit you with hearing aids in my old office at Miracle Ear, which was documented in
the
award-winning motion picture, Perfect Sound Forever.
Lucy Arnell.
That's right. Camera work by Lucy.
Great job.
It was incredible cinematography. I saw you guys that night at the Orpheum. It was an incredible show. September 12th, we recorded the Watery Domestic sub show. And then you bid adieu from my life, for the most part, for 10 months or so.
Well, you've gotten more of my time than most people.
And I appreciate that.
You feel any better. Yeah, well, I'm pretty isolated.
I don't see you as a guest. I mean, especially, honestly, with the type 1, you know my attitude. I'll stop somebody on the street if I see a Dexcom. No, for that reason alone, and the impact that the band has had in my life, but then also you're just, you know, swooping through my life and then onto the Pavement tour. So the Pavement series was the first real indication that the show as a proof of concept was actually rock solid. We had had Anthony Fantano on the program doing the Velvet Underground, and that was big, but it was the confluence of the reunion tour, the sheer volume of material that you and I had put together, and also the sincerity and the high quality of the episodes themselves. It left me with an audience.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. A lot of very patient people out there.
No, I mean, the first 4 Pavement episodes are in popularity numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Good old Pavement fans. They're so determined.
That was the beginning of my more long-form style interviews, which so far has surpassed the 8 hours you and I did and has peaked with the association, 13 hours.
How is Pajo? Do you have a good time with Pajo? He's not a man of many words usually.
Oh, man. So that was 9 hours. That went beyond.
Oh, jeez. I can't believe that.
He loved it. He said it was the most well-researched and best interview he's ever done.
But he's such an... I mean, he's had such a great career.
It's so many different pockets, and we talked about it all.
Yeah. What an interesting character. I mean, he's brilliant, obviously. It's cool that he's got that Gang of Four gig. I was pretty excited about that myself. Did you see them? Have you seen them play?
I haven't. No, I haven't.
I'd like to see that.
So I just want to say that, you know, in terms of the It's a Wonderful Life, how have I impacted this guy's existence kind of thing. So David David Pajo did a hot seat interview. Vashti Bunyan just rated everything she ever did, and the guys from the Association. So,
those are some big, those are some heavy hitters.
Yeah.
Compared to the percussionist guy from Pavement.
I love the self-denigrating thing, but your appearance and everything that happened after that was getting very serious about this show. And I just want to say, really, all the fulcrum point was you. So here's what happened. I want you to know this. As soon as
I tricked you into thinking that.
As soon as you blew through my life, here's what I was left with. I was left with 8.5 hours of audio that I desperately wanted to do you the good service of editing out all the ums and ands. Here's how that impacted me.
I'll work on that. It's all about saving your time.
No. It's about showcasing you at your best. So I wound up going to work and for 9 hours a day, every day, edited your material because I no longer had it in me to focus on the career I'd had. So I left that job. I left that career. This is your fault. And I moved back. Entirely because of you. And I moved back to the East Coast and I almost bled to death 2 months ago. And that
brings In Jersey. I can't remember what's the exact place you were living out in the Southern California area.
In Long Beach.
And you enjoyed that. And you were there for how long?
I came out to Los Angeles from New Jersey 15 years ago and then moved out to Long Beach a few years ago to be with my wife.
Okay, so you were single when you moved out to Los Angeles.
Right.
And how long have you been married?
8 years.
And she's also moved from Long Beach to...
She's a townie, so this is a huge move for her.
Oh, God. Well, that's the most important thing. How's she doing with that adjustment?
She's okay. You know, you're a sweetheart. The very first thing that came out of your mouth during our interview last time was, how's your son? How's your wife? You're a very nice guy.
But yeah, no, I mean, obviously you don't fly solo. I mean, you've got a unit. I've done both. I know, of course, I've never experienced children. That's a completely different set of situations.
It's intense. I mean, my son, before he's, you know,
really... He's like six or something, right? Or four?
He's four. He was 3.5 when we initially spoke. You know, he's watched his dad initially go to work in a lab coat and now hang out all fucking scruffy, you know, just putting shows together and that, you know, 4-year-old going, Daddy, I want to hear Discog Graffiti.
What happened to you?
I had a hemorrhoidectomy, which sounds funny, but over the last few years, every morning I'd wake up and every single morning started the same way. And it was not a good thing.
Grim.
And so I knew I did a bunch of stuff and it was not enough. And so I needed this one procedure, which they told me was going to be excruciating. So,
I
put it off until I got here.
I didn't want it to affect the move.
Well, not even that. There was not enough support out there. Cause with just Jen and I, that's it. There's no real support system. So,
Saint Jen, I call her.
She is Saint Jen. I think she just found her favorite part of this episode. So what happened was I did it. It's a very cut and dried sort of operation. The pain was intense. This was April 18th. And then the morning of the 24th, I was laying in the bathtub reading Mojo magazine on my phone on an app. My 4-year-old came in, Mason pointed at the water and said, Daddy, what's that? And I looked down. The whole bathtub was his blood. It was like a Kubrick movie or a Lynch film.
All hell broke loose.
That's amazing.
You were concentrating so hard on Mojo, you were aware of the change of coloration in the wall.
Yeah, at all. I didn't see it at all.
I mean, because I could see you not feeling that. But there was
no pain from it. Like, it was, I believe, scar tissue that opened up and I just bled out. And what happened was,
man,
I didn't stop bleeding. And in that moment,
you just go straight to the emergency room, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the best thinking I had at that moment was...
Was there any pain? Could you feel anything?
No, but I felt bleeding out and it didn't stop.
Yeah.
It was coming and coming and coming. And I had a double blood transfusion.
How long did it take you to get to the hospital?
That's the one thing is that there's a hospital 5 minutes away from me, but my best thinking...
That's pretty huge. You got real lucky in that regard.
No, I did not. Because my best thinking at that moment was, let's go to the hospital where I had the operations for continuity of treatment. That hospital's a 30-minute drive away. By the time I got there...
Oh,
I was almost dead.
So I was going to say the 5-minute thing. I think he probably would have nipped it in the bud. Whoa.
So life is
just gone horrible between minutes 20 and 30.
I was sweating profusely, screaming. My dad drove me. That's another thing. No ambulance.
Oh, your dad lives in the hood.
Yeah. Yeah, in the hood.
He saved your life, sort of.
I don't know about you, man.
He didn't have his hearing aid in.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, you can always make light of these situations now that they're over. Like, my bandmates had a really good time. Like, for one thing, when you do have, this is kind of a horrible thing to recommend, but if you are ever really late for a flight, you and your wife, one of you can hop in a wheelchair and, you know, essentially fake an injury and go straight to the front of the line everywhere, including airport security and every line you have to deal with.
I don't think you and I need to do that.
I'm saying, you know, those airport situations. In fact, last year I was in an airport in Seattle in a TSA line that was like almost 2 hours long and barely made the flight. When I was in this wheelchair for several flights being pushed around by either Malkmus or Steve West, they just let us go straight to the front of the line everywhere. It was pretty awesome. That doesn't really have anything to do with your bleeding ass. So basically they were able to get the transfusions. If you were cognizant of what was going on through the entire process once you actually made it to the hospital in your dad's car?
I counted how many people were in the, how many doctors and nurses were in the emergency room. You got
to
figure.
So you get to the hospital and your dad drives you there and you take it from here, take it from there.
No, please. This is a conversation. It's not a monologue. I want to hear
what happened once you got to the hospital. For example, when I got to the hospital that late night in Melbourne, I had to wait for 45 minutes. This was a situation in your case that was obviously waiting was not going to work.
Right. You know, I was waiting in the fucking lobby. I don't think they understood what was going on because it wasn't like I was
covered. Wasn't there blood everywhere?
It was just me doubled over.
And I don't know. Because I've been in immediate care situations. In fact, this leg was an immediate care situation where I had to wait for 3.5 hours. You know, you think you're going to be next and then somebody comes in and they're just hysterical and they let them go in front of you.
No, I got in there quick, but
okay,
when...
Yeah, I was going to say, man, how many people have died in emergency room waiting rooms?
No. I'm a relatively persistent person.
I can see that, especially when you're bleeding out from the posterior.
Yes. Well, so I was...
Okay, so go with the procedure. I mean, how do they save your ass?
So I'm in there and the one of the doctors has her finger up my rectum and is like holding the wound closed with her hand. And I had just posted a show that morning and I was like, you're not going to believe this.
Probably a bad time to recommend your podcast.
You don't understand. I'm not selling the show. These ideas, I'm thinking about them all the time. I'm just talking about the band. I'm not pushing the show. So, right. And I don't know if you know this, but you know, the Beatles had the Monkees. Did you know the Monkees had their own monkeys and they were called the Chimps?
No.
I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I'm bleeding.
I'm terrible at music trivia. I've told you that many times.
So I'm explaining to this doctor, isn't that insane? The Monkees had their own monkeys. And I'm on fentanyl. They're pumping whatever they're putting in me. And I count, there's 10 doctors in there. Maybe doctors and nurses. And so I figure that's got to be somebody who's dying or they would not waste that many people. So I've never asked this question before, but I started yelling, is this it? Is this it? Because, you know, my mom and dad and my wife are in the hall and I've got to hurry up and drum up something quasi portentous to say to them, some kind of goodbye if this is it, because I felt like I was being pulled away.
Understandably so.
Yeah.
That's very traumatic. I've been pretty reckless in a lot of ways in my life and I've spent very little time in the hospital. My family does not do well in the hospital. My mother and father, my late father and my mother, he's very much alive. They really can't stand hospitals. Some people don't mind it. That's an interesting thing that runs in our family.
There's an aspect of it that I do like. It's almost relaxing because there's nothing you need to focus on except getting better.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. But then there's also that anxiety of like wanting to get the hell out of there and getting back to your... I mean, it's just, I think we're sort of, for lack of a better word, spoiled in that regard, is that our routine, no matter how inane it is something that, you know, we've grown comfortable with that we sort of rely on and enjoy. I think that if you embrace your routine, I mean, you can handle obviously getting thrown off of it several times a week, but there's a certain amount of comfort in that. And I think just the lack of self-control when you're in the hospital is unsettling. My situation was quite a bit different because I felt fine the entire time I was in there. You know, I was on like a 5.5 foot bed overnight. And the worst thing was, is that, you know, when you have these type of panicky situations, I just always start drinking huge amounts of water. So I probably drank 3 or 4 gallons of water.
Is that just a calming thing?
I don't know what it is. I just think it's like fear of dehydration. I had just played a hot concert that was, you know, 2 hours long. I just always think that water might remedy the situation. You know, they always say that, like, make sure you're hydrated. So I actually panic drink water, or sometimes when I'm upset about something, I'll just like drink. I can drink like 7 bottles of water like in 3 minutes, you know.
Yeah, you can die like that.
I know, I've heard about that. You can die a lot of ways, and it's pretty far down the list of ones that I'm worried about, the over drinking water.
I'm just curious at what level it becomes an issue.
I don't know, but I've never pushed the envelope. But I mean, yeah. It might have become an issue on this particular occasion, because unlike you in your emergency room situation with all the doctors around you, I was having a hard time really getting anybody's attention. In fact, my wounds were never really properly dressed, and they were more concerned about my blood and the numbers in regards to my blood, which was understandable because my sodium levels had gone way, way down to a dangerous level. But at the same time, I had like this massive gash on my chin. But one of the aspects of drinking all of that water was I had to pee constantly. And how much peeing have you done in your life lying on your back, you know, where you can't really move at all because you're physically damaged in a hospital bed?
Well, I mean, I was catheterized for this past.
Yeah, but I mean, I had no catheter. Okay, oh, so wow. Like, it's incredibly difficult. They hand you these things that are kind of shaped like a giant cardboard stomach. It's incredibly difficult to lean over on your side and pee into one of these things. And I was peeing, I think if I had to guess, it was probably like maybe 3/4 of a gallon, this thing. And I must have filled 7 of them. But then they tell you, like, when you're in the emergency room, you can just hit this button and somebody will come. Well, I haven't slept. It was during by far the most arduous stretch, but was a very luxurious tour by pavement of Japan and Australia at that point. And this is the only like difficult run that we had. And touring in Australia is such a blissed out, good experience, and always has been. But probably the only demanding part is you pretty much have to get up every morning and fly.
Mm-hmm. Do they love you out there? They must love you out there.
You know, I don't know they. I just know that pavement fans, if they're there, you know, and I think this is probably the case with a lot of bands, current and past, with, you know, hardcore devotees. You know, everywhere we go, thankfully, we wouldn't go. I mean, our booking agent wouldn't put us in places where there weren't, you know, at least several hundred hardcore pavement fans. And the places that we play there, Perth, Brisbane, Adelaide, Melbourne, and Sydney, you know, we played more over the years, but those are the main ones. They're into it.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome. We played this other place. Of course, I missed the one place. We played this other really cool place. It was like by the beach. Right now, the name is Casey.
That unfortunate tumble that you took. Beyond that, like in a general sense, especially with the shit that you and I have to contend with, what's the reality of touring for you these days as opposed to back in the 90s?
Oh, I was having a wonderful, wonderful time on this particular tour and felt great. Again, like I was saying, it's very luxurious in terms of, you know, number of performances per week. I was looking at Bruce Springsteen's concert schedule not too long ago, and that guy does it. I mean, I know it's hard on him because he's
old. He's in his
mid-70s, you know, but he's so fit, and they're really fit, and they have nutritionists, and they work out. You know, I'm sure they're healthier than me. I don't know about you, but they play like 3 shows a week, you know. So this particular stretch of touring is great. I mean, touring is actually way easier in both 2010 and 2022 and 2023 than it was
right
back then, because there's, and just like everybody else, when you're young and you're touring, you're trying to live up to somebody else's expectations in a way, you know, whether it's the record label or whoever. There's always somebody around that wants it to be a bigger deal than perhaps maybe what it was cut out to be. You know, sort of in my mind, Pavement always overachieved in terms of sales and in terms of opportunities and in terms of places that we played. I mean, I've always felt like it was a major success, but there's always, in the 90s, there's always a certain amount of, they could have been this, they could have been that, they could have been, you know, the main phrase that would get bandied about would be they could have been the next Nirvana. Like, who would want that, really? I mean, it looks very unpleasant to be in Nirvana in the first place.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this tour supposed to be 6 weeks and it just never ended?
Same with 2010. I think basically the way it works is basically it was fully intended to be, yeah, no, in 2020, it was supposed to really just be the Primavera performances. And then if those went well, we might start booking dates. And then that option was thrown out the window in 2022 post-pandemic, because so many bands and so many types of performers that play all of these venues. So you just had to make a decision. You couldn't just like feel your way around. There's so many venues you have to book years in advance not to play certain places. I mean, unless you're somebody that pushes somebody else out of the way. So you just have to sort of commit. We committed to do Primavera and then, you know, Europe and the States. States and then Europe. And we just did that Australia, New Zealand, Japan thing, which was sort of logical in the timing. What's been surprising to me is that when we finished in Dublin, I kind of felt like it was over then, because those tours you do, which we've done several times before, of, you know, where you combine Japan, Australia, New Zealand, they're like almost like vacation-y type tours. I mean, it's just a much easier schedule. So yeah, anything that's been added on since then, which basically starts here in a few days in July in Bilbao in Spain, was unexpected and is a great surprise to me. We did the one thing in Salt Lake City, I guess at this point, less than a couple months ago. And anything we're doing this year beyond New Zealand is surprising to me, and that's 13 concerts. We've got Bilbao in early July, then we've got Blue Dot Festival in Macclesfield, England in July, then Galway a couple of days after that, then three in Iceland, and I think three is probably clearly going to be too many there.
By the way, Disco Graffiti is in the top five music commentary shows in Iceland. I don't know why I'm huge in Iceland, but...
Oh, cool, yeah. Maybe you should promote the show, because we're having a hard time moving the units over there.
Hell yeah, yeah. That'd be crazy if I could help you sell out there, man.
I don't think that you'll be able... You'd have to, like, go to Reykjavik right now and start hawking.
I'm down. Whatever you fucking need, man. This is, I almost bled to death, so this is all
Jen, we're moving to Reykjavik.
St. Jen, come on, back your bags.
Yeah, you know, then pack it in, poor kid. So, yeah, who knows?
Is this it then? Because I remember you saying...
I don't know, man. It's never up to me. It's up to Malkmus.
Is he seeing this as a launch pad to further Jick stuff? Or is he seeing this as a reignition? You know,
no, he's interested in doing his, you know, what he's been doing with traditional techniques and the album for it. His solo career, I think, is his main priority in terms of his creative output.
I got to tell you, all his totally solo stuff without the Jicks, it's fucking great.
Yeah, I think it's good. He's great. He's amazingly talented. I just think that that's going to be his priority going forward. I think he's enjoyed doing Pavement. I think he's well aware of it's the thing that he's most recognized for.
Is he at peace with that, or is he battle against it like a Wings Beatles thing?
These are the things that
you know the answer to that. Come on. Hey guys, before we go on, I just got to tell you about this amazing podcast I came across. I feel like I may be the last one to the show on this, but these guys are absolutely amazing. First, greatest show title ever. It's called the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. I mean, genius, right? But these guys absolutely live up to it. It's Jason Colvin and James D. Graves, and they usually pit two iconic movies or albums against each other to pick which is best, like Jaws versus Jurassic Park or Appetite for Destruction versus Back in Black. But they're so well researched that they never fail to blow my mind, and so funny that they never fail to make me laugh. It's the best of all worlds. Plus, they've started a series of top five lists this season that totally take me back to the misspent days of my youth. I can't recommend them enough. The Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. Check it out.
No. Only his wife, May, or his manager. He has a manager that I've never met, that I don't really ever recall being around in 2022. He also has the same booking agent that Pavement has, who's, you know, almost been a de facto type manager person throughout his career. who sort of, you know, advises him, and Botch plays his name, David Vicelli, sort of like, you know, he's a very effective communicator, Botch, and he can speak very plainly and effectively to Malkmus about, you know, you need to do this if you want to do this. So, you know, what goes on in his mind in regards to his own career doesn't really apply to me. And to be quite honest, all I ever do is wish him the absolute best. I mean, who am I to give that guy advice? I just know that it's been real fun, both in 2010 and this year, and 2022 and 2023, to have a good time doing the shows. And I think, you know, physically and mentally, we've been up for it. And the addition of Rebecca, as I've talked about before on this program, has been a major plus in terms of making it easier, fun, more relaxing, just a better musical experience. You know, I think basically just about everybody else in the band is in the same position that, you know, give us, in my case, maybe 3 days notice, but I think most people like 45 to 60 or 60 to 90 days notice. And again, our booking agent is very good at communicating game plans. And it's all, I think that's the way all these bands who existed during a different frame of time work. I think basically you go out there and you realize that, whoa, you know, people are still very interested in this. And I think if you sort of space it out, then it has some effect. I think that at this point, I wouldn't go so far as to say that we've worn out our welcome, but I do think that it's probably best for us to stop.
Yeah, it depends what you're trying to achieve, right? But it sounds like, based on what Steven seems to be trying to achieve, you're totally right. Because you got the show that's being made, you have the tributes at the museum, right?
There's some movie being made that's supposed to come out. I had a conversation, a Zoom, not too long ago. It's a pavement biopic that's being made.
That's bizarre. I'm not even referring to that. I didn't even know about that. That's
wild. Oh, yeah. There's a pavement biopic. I think it's due out in 2024, 2025. It's by this filmmaker named Alex Ross Perry.
And yeah, sure.
There's a lot of famous people that are playing us in it. I had to do a Zoom with a very nice, enthusiastic young man who I really liked.
Wasn't it a musical? I thought I'd read something.
That was something they did in Brooklyn.
Okay. This is like a victory lap beyond all bounds. It must feel amazing. The love toward you guys is definitely not conceptual. You must feel it wherever you go in the pavement intensive areas.
I mean, you know, it's weird because I don't go really that many places if I'm not a member of Pave. I do find myself on the British race course, but I do have this life, and I have had it for a long time, where when I'm not doing pavement, my life really hardly be more unrock. And the same can be said for Steve West, for sure.
You know, he's a mason, right?
Yeah, he's a stonemason. He lives sort of in the middle of nowhere outside of Lexington, Virginia. But, you know, at the same time, he's got a recording studio and he actively participates in playing with bands. I think every Tuesday is his like practice day where he practices with a couple of different musical acts. So he still maintains his chops. He's still got his finger on the pulse.
So if you could go back and do it all over again, would you have delved into the equestrian world, or would you have done everything exactly the same?
No, I mean, I basically, you know, when you're not doing pavement, in fact, I'm still charting races right now. I mean, in fact, I've got to turn in yesterday's races from Canterbury to Thoroughgraph.
So when you're done with pavement, what's the day-to-day? Is it mainly Broker's Tip?
No, Broker's Tip's dead.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's so hard. I mean, obviously the last year I couldn't really do too much because it's just, you know, you're running a small record label by yourself, and it's just, I couldn't promote it effectively. I was kind of had this certain amount of naivete that you could sort of pull it off the same way that little labels did in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, whether it be like Amphetamine Reptile or, you know, HX Records or, you know, it just doesn't work that way anymore. I don't know. Maybe it does for some people. I mean, I love the music that I put out.
By the way, you know who's become not just an avid follower of the show, but a close friend is Patrick Tabe Fleming.
Oh, he's a very enthusiastic young man.
Awesome guy, man. I'm not setting up a label, but I'm dipping my toe into sort of Hal Willner territory as a way to sort of help put the pedal to the metal on starting to monitor or just be able to feed my family while I do this.
Yeah.
I know you're familiar with Metal Machine Music. I don't have to ask you if you're a fan.
Oh, I'm indifferent.
Oh, really? Okay, so I've always loved it as a thing.
Just you know my thing about old music.
Not as cool as new music, right?
No. I never really listened to any music that was made before the late 70s until I was well into my adulthood, because my thinking was there was so much incredible stuff going on where I had the fortune of growing up in Richmond, Virginia, there's, you know, we had great record stores and we had great venues and we had great live music indoors and outdoors that, you know, I was really spoiled. And I started getting into it really around 80, 81, you know, going to see bands and buying records. And, you know, there was so much going on that was current that even like bands that were like, you know, people would say, well, they sound exactly like Big Star. And like, I've never listened to Big Star. Big Star sort of existed before I listened to music. You know what I'm saying? So I don't really know that. Yeah, anything like that. So I remember doing college radio and like Velvet Underground. They started putting out Velvet Underground compilations that were super cool and you know, basically were being mentioned by not only REM, but dozens of other bands that I love as being this, you know, massive influence. So Velvet Underground would have been the first band that I sort of listened to.
I got to tell you about this idea because it's pretty fucking sweet. It's a double album that Lou Reed did that's just guitar feedback, about 30 different fucking tracks that just...
That's the Metal Machine Music thing, right?
Exactly. So this
is... I'm aware of it. I mean, I've obviously heard many critics reference it over the years. It's unlistenable, right? It's unlistenable.
Well, I've listened to it all the way through.
Yeah, but you're riddled by self-hate.
That's precisely it, but I wanted to see what kind of brain activity does it produce. Just as an exercise in an endurance test kind of a thing, it's pretty intriguing. And
wasn't he just like, Lou Reed was like, had this...
Amphetamine problem. It was just an amphetamine abuse problem, and I think he was trying to get out of a record contract, so it was a perfect
storm. Just seemed so miserable. He was so mean-spirited.
So at the end of his life, he was doing Tai Chi and was making ambient music. That was the end of his life. The idea that somebody could do such a 180 flip like that got me to thinking, and this is like a while ago, I'm putting together a comp called Metal Machine Muzak. So the only rule is that it has to be 16 minutes and 1 second, which is the length of every single side of that record. Otherwise, it's just an ambient reimagining of all four sides. Lou Barlow's doing one side. He's currently working on it.
Good choice.
Corey Hansen from Wand is doing a side. And Mark Robinson from Unrest and about 100 other great bands.
Oh, so you got the heavy hitters. See, that's the problem with Broker's Tip. I had all these people that nobody is aware of. Quite brilliant artists.
And I'm going to ask Bob Mould.
Those all automatically sell based on the personnel. So I think that's exactly a really good idea. I mean, if you line up, you know, if you can trick those fools that you've already tricked into doing something that punishing for you, that then mission accomplished.
No, those guys are real sweethearts. And
I know they're all brilliant, but I mean, I know all
three. No, but good people, like very, very
sweet. Oh, I mean, they're wonderful people, but then, you know, I think that probably when you ask them, I can see their reactions and they're probably all set up to like do it. And I don't know, hypothetically in Lou's case, whether it's going to take 45 minutes or 4 days, but yeah, it's the kind of thing that they should be able to be amused by and get a kick out of. I mean,
yeah,
they're obviously very prolific artists.
All right, that about does it. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Bob Nastanovich, also obviously Steve Malkmus and the rest of Pavement, Matador Records, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the soldiers of sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. In fact, I know firsthand about some very exciting projects coming together because of fellow soldiers who collided in our incredible group. Honestly, it is objectively the only worthwhile thing that's come from Zuckerberg's college efforts. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into Discography's pantheon of irrefutably mind-blowing Pavement and Gen X-centric episodes is to start with the Motherload, episode 49, the all-time most popular Discography episode, which kicks off a Pavement-only streak that takes us all the way to episode 58, and then we barrel head-on into Lou Barlow and then Jim Florentine doing Black Sabbath. You get the idea. But wait just a minute. This is just the entrance to the rabbit hole. Join us as we descend down, down, down on Discography's week-long Double Fantasy Deep Dive. Of course, if you're a Patreon subscriber, then you already know to keep your ears peeled throughout the week, because this Monday brings a heapin' helpin' of the wildcard episode digressions. I aggressively court and then serve up piping hot for our Patreons, and this week, it's Double Fantasy bonus material. And then there's this Wednesday's incredible Patreon-only episode of Discography's Top 10. This week's list features the indomitable Joe Kennedy and focuses on our Top 10 Minutemen songs, an officially sanctioned release as it's Nastanovich's favorite band. Make sure you visit patreon.com/discography and check out the thematically related deep dive as a music obsessive's way of life. Our Patreon's been up and running for a year, and with two episodes a week reliably posted there. There are 100 Patreon episodes at this point. That's an entire universe of incredible material available to you for the price of a cup of coffee a week. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, October 20th, we're coming at you with part two of our exclusive post-tour interview with the beating heart of Pavement, Bob Nastanovich. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography.